Advances in medical science make living longer possible, but all advances also seem to come with ethical issues, like we can keep you alive, but should we? And at the other end of life, we can manipulate DNA to create defect-free children, but should we? These and more are considered in a thought-provoking book by Jacob Apple called Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. Jacob Apple is a psychiatrist, teacher of bioethics at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York City, a Harvard Law graduate, and a prolific author. His previous books include story collections, a book of essays, and five novels. Jacob Apple, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
Are the ethical issues, do you think, coming faster at the medical profession than they used to?
Oh, absolutely. I think that technology is advancing very rapidly, and neither law nor ethics are keeping pace. And it's exacerbated by a very polarized society where our politicians, our thought leaders, feel uncomfortable grappling with these issues, so they get left by the wayside.
Oh, so technology once again gets ahead of the ethical considerations, and then it's exacerbated, as you said, by political crossfire.
Yeah, I can offer you a very concrete example.
Mm-hmm.
So I ask many of your listeners to probably lock their doors before getting in their cars to go to work this morning, but how many of them have dusted the DNA off their doorknobs? And the answer is probably very few. And yet DNA theft, because of legislative inaction, remains perfectly legal in a number of states, and a stranger could swipe your DNA from your doorknob. They could test it, find out whether you're at risk for certain diseases, send it to your long-term care insurer who could use it against you, or send it to a relative to find out that your father isn't your father.
Wow. So, and I imagine, given the fact that members of the Senate, for example, didn't know how Facebook got its money, they probably didn't have any legislation on DNA theft.
Oh, no. So the legislature, the only issue that the legislature regularly addresses in relation to bioethics is human cloning. And yet I go around and lecture audiences all over the world, and I ask people, how many of you want to be cloned? And no one ever raises their hand. So clearly we're barking up the wrong tree.
There's another early example from the book, The Three-Parent Baby. What happens there?
Sure. So many of your listeners probably remember from high school biology that the DNA in a cell can either be in the nucleus or in the cytoplasm in the mitochondria. And what you can do is you can take the DNA nucleus out of the cell and push it into the cytoplasm of a different cell, a different egg cell from a different mother, and then fertilize that, and you'll have a baby with three genetic parents. Now, you can go one step further and have a different woman carry that embryo to term, and then you'll have a baby with one father and three biological mothers. And so the technology is fairly advanced, and we can do that to prevent certain rare diseases. On the other hand, the law has not really caught up because it hasn't determined in a uniform way who the actual legal parents are in these different cases, and who gets to make decisions for the child.
Just because legislatures haven't dealt with it doesn't mean courts haven't. Is there any case law on this yet?
So there's some, but it's contradictory. It's sort of in the same way that surrogate motherhood is legal in some states, not legal in others. And you can be a child's parent in one state, but if it's committed a crime by agreeing to sire them or bring them to term in a different state.
Interesting. So now many listeners can hear the examples of the things you put in Who Says You're Dead and think, well, that won't happen to me. But you know, it's not just big stuff with you know, looming ethical considerations. It's issues like electronic medical records. I mean, what are some of the issues that are arising there?
Sure. So we hear all the good things about electronic medical records, although there is a lot of concern they actually burn out doctors and make your doctors have less time for you. But even if we had an interoperable international or national medical record, it would require something like 12 to 14 million people to have access to your record if they needed to, which meant that a very effective hacker in Russia or China could break into the entire national medical record and post it online. And you could imagine the devastation that would cause. I tell people there are probably few terrorist attacks that could do more long-term damage than posting everybody's most intimate confidential secrets, whether they've ever used drugs, whether they've had an abortion, their mental health histories, available for all on the internet.
So are they centrally located? I mean, is that the ultimate goal that somebody, you know, if you move from California to Maine, for example, and your new doctor wants your records from California, they should be able to go to a central database and pick them up?
I mean, that is the goal for many people in the field, and there are upsides to that, too. It's if you collapse on the street in Maine, they'll be able to take an armband that you're wearing or some basic information and find out your entire medical record very quickly. It might be able to save your life, but that's a significant trade-off. What I tell people is when celebrities check into the hospital, often people look up their medical records and are fired. This happened with Bill Clinton in New York, with Farrah Fawcett in California. When ordinary people check into the hospital, there's really very limited safeguards. There could be more. There just aren't.
So, Jacob, talk about the way the book is constructed. I mean, is most of the book hypotheticals, or do these all come back to cases that really happened?
So all of the cases are either cases that have happened or composites of several cases that are very closely related that have happened. Some have happened to me personally in my practice. Some were referred to me by other doctors or I'm aware of from colleagues. Many are drawn from the news. But the goal, this is not a book for doctors or medical students. It's a goal for educated lay people and people who want to educate themselves about this. So I try to make it entertaining. I offer a hypothetical scenario and then a discussion of how different people have or might address the questions. But the people I draw upon are celebrities, figures in pop culture, historical figures, to make it a much more interesting read for people.
And it is an interesting read, and it's each segment short and snappy with all the different examples coming fast and furious. I didn't realize, among other things, that the Hippocratic Oath forbade surgery. It said, don't do this to people.
Yeah, we think of the Hippocratic Oath today as an ethics rule, but it was primarily a guild rule back in ancient Greece, as far as we know. So it says things like you shouldn't teach medicine to anybody other than the sons of other doctors. And one of the implicit rules, it says you shouldn't do surgery, but implicitly there probably was a code for surgeons that said you shouldn't practice medicine so that our turf didn't interfere with their turf and vice versa.
So let's jump into the examples here, Jacob. Lay out the you're not my daddy story.
Sure. So something that occurs more often than one might think are people come in for medical testing. For example, a woman will come in to see whether she is a potential kidney donor, a match to her father. And they'll discover there's bad news and there's worse news. The bad news will be that she's not a match, and the worst news will be that she's not her father's daughter. And then the question that arises for the hospital is, should they tell her? Should they tell the father? Shouldn't they? And there are ethical arguments on either side. If you tell the family, obviously this will be devastating news. But if you don't tell them, the daughter may assume a false genetic history, might not get screened before she gives birth to children for certain genetic diseases. If she thinks she comes from a long line of Scandinavians and diseases primarily affect Ashkenazi Jews, she might not have herself tested, and she might report false history to her doctor. She might say she has no family history of early onset colon cancer, so they never test her or never take precautions, and then she dies young. So it has significant implications.
And is the default situation for most doctors that more information is good?
Not necessarily. We know that some hospitals have a policy of telling you. Some hospitals have a policy of not telling you, and some hospitals now have a policy of telling you that if they discover you're not genetically related, they're not going to tell you. But if you think that case is hard, a harder permutation of this, which I believe has occurred at least once, is a husband and wife come forward to see if they are matches to donate a kidney, and there's good news and quote-unquote better news. The good news is that they are a match, and the better news is that they are biological siblings. And then the question arises, do you tell them? Because obviously there are reproductive issues and child and genetic issues involved in here, but you'll also pose significant emotional consequences and might legally eliminate their marriage, dissolve their marriage in some jurisdictions. And then I ask, does context matter? Does it matter if they're at childbearing age or past childbearing age?
Wow. So let's talk about, though, if the person asks the direct question, it's like, what did you find? I mean, is this not my daughter? Is he not my father? I mean, if they ask the direct question, will the hospital just decline to answer or say we can't tell you? Or what's the usual approach?
In some hospitals, they will tell you in advance that if you ask that, we're not going to answer that, which actually makes the question easier to answer. In others, if you don't ask that in advance, they can tell you it's the hospital policy not to answer that. But it's analogous to if you ask your spouse, are you having an extramarital affair? And he or she says, I'd rather not discuss that. That tells you a lot.
So the whole realm of informed consent, I mean, how well informed are patients? What is required for them to know when they're giving their consent to procedures to be done on them?
Sure. So I think it's a misnomer in some ways. What we reasonably mean is reasonable disclosure. We don't actually care usually whether the patient really understood with a capital R. We care whether the doctor told them what a reasonable patient would want to hear in order to make that decision. And the reason why we use an objective standard rather than a subjective one is the alternative opens itself up to the equivalent of calling the Sunday afternoon football plays on Monday morning quarterbacking or hindsight being 20/20. The patient would always say they never really understood if a negative consequence occurs. Hmm. That being said, doctors have so much power in how they share information that the patient, one might argue, is usually not very well informed. The most simple example I can use is your dentist probably gives you a long list of risks involved when your wisdom teeth are taken out and you sign a boilerplate card, but you don't really believe they're going to occur. If a dentist sat down next to you and said, one of the risks of having your wisdom teeth taken out is you could die here in my office, most people wouldn't do it. Now, that would be meaningful informed consent, but probably too much information.
Huh. So there's ethics just in the amount of information delivered when you start the procedure.
Yeah, like one issue that comes up often is you tell people you have a 60% track record in performing the surgery. Do you have an ethical obligation to tell them that someone else has a 70% track record in performing the surgery successfully?
You're not about to tell somebody if the guy across town is actually a little better than me at this.
I mean, the law does not currently expect that, but what if your success rate is 5% and his success rate is 70%? What if you've never done it before? What if you've seen a YouTube video? Is there some tipping point beyond which you have to tell them?
Tell me there aren't people who, the surgeons with 5% success rates at certain surgeries, please.
There are some procedures that are very risky, that are very high stakes, and there are some people who are far better at them than others. On the other hand, people wouldn't get better at them if they didn't get a chance to practice, and there's also a significant economic or class implication to this. If you tell people at my local community hospital, who are generally indigent, that we have a 50% success rate, but they have a 70% success rate at the Mayo Clinic in Minnesota, that's like telling them there's a 70% success rate on the moon. If they can't get there, it doesn't do them any good.
Jacob Apple's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking bioethics. He is a bioethicist. He is a psychiatrist, MD, and a graduate of Harvard Law School. His book is called Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. Let's talk about doctor-patient confidentiality. Does criminal behavior, past or present, break the bond?
Sure, and that's a very complicated question. Historically, doctors only had duties to their patients individually, fiduciary duty. But with time, that duty has expanded, and now there's a duty to the public as well. And some areas are fairly clear-cut. If I believe you're going to kill a stranger, I have some obligation to find that stranger and tell them or take action to protect them. But other areas are much grayer. Let us say that I'm a driver, and I come to you for assistance with my alcohol problem. And while I'm getting care, I'm still going to be driving drunk. Do you have an obligation to report me to the Department of Motor Vehicles, which will take my license away, probably drive me out of care? And some states say yes, and some states say no, and some states say the doctor gets to decide. And then does it matter if, rather than being a driver who drives once a month with my Cadillac to buy my groceries, drives a school bus or flies a commercial airplane? So there's a lot of cost-benefit analysis.
Now, how about for crime victims? If they say, I don't want you to, do not report to the police what happened to me. I mean, with kids particularly, there's mandatory reporting, isn't there? But how about for adults?
Yeah, so with children, we've decided that children are not in a place to make these decisions when their parents aren't. And we forcibly require providers and a whole range of people to mandatorily report. But for other questions, like, for example, for intimate partner violence, some states require reporting, some states permit it, some states prohibit it. Some states take the position that the victims of intimate partner violence are best able to decide whether or not they want this information reported because they have to live with the consequences, as well as the fear that if people know this is going to be reported, they actually won't get the medical care they need. Often the states have taken the position with specific crimes that if you committed a crime in the past that you're unlikely to commit again, doctors can't breach confidentiality, even if it means someone is suffering as a result. So if I've hidden the body somewhere and no one knows. But if you're likely to cause future harm or commit a future crime, then it becomes much more complicated how imminent it has to be, what kind of crime it has to be. Generally, if you're going to commit embezzlement, your doctors can't breach confidentiality. But if you're going to do something more dangerous, they might have to.
Now, how about if nothing has actually been done, but people are thinking of doing awful things? You know, they talk about having these fantasies of doing something horrible, and people can use their imaginations here. But, you know, if they tell this to their psychiatrist, what does that person have to do, if anything?
I mean, it often places psychiatrists in this difficult bind, because if you do breach confidentiality, sometimes you can be liable, and often you can damage the patient's care and your relationship with the patient. But in the rare cases where you don't tell anyone and there's a negative outcome, then you can sometimes be liable for the consequences.
All right. There's a scenario in here called when the president has a secret. I have used the example of FDR with congestive heart failure in setting up this segment. But you give the story of a candidate with psychiatric history. Tell us.
Sure. So, and this is my example is theoretical, but this has happened before with Tom Eagleton, who ran for president in vice president in 1972, and George McGovern appointed him as a vice presidential candidate and then dropped him from the ticket shortly thereafter when it became known that he had shock therapy. But the larger question is, to what degree do the president's doctors have an obligation to the general public or a presidential candidate's doctors to share information about them that might make them unfit for the presidency? Can they breach confidentiality to do this? Should they breach confidentiality to do this? Without getting into any specific politicians, I think this has come up with a number of politicians in recent years. It came up certainly in the case of Paul Tsongas, whose doctors arguably were not fully forthcoming about his risk of cancer recurrence during his 1992 campaign.
Our guest is Jacob Apple. He is a psychiatrist, a law school graduate from Harvard University, and obviously an MD since he's a psychiatrist. He's written a book getting us to think about some medical ethical situations. It's called Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. You can join our conversation on the Exchange as we run through the list of medical ethical issues, and there are many, and we're not going to get them all in this hour. Join us at 800-838-3760 with phone calls. Send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. Let's jump to another political topic, physicians and enhanced interrogations. That appears in the book. Tell us about the things that a doctor would have to go through in that situation and have.
Sure. So one question that arises is, to what degree more broadly can doctors be involved with actions of the state that don't serve the individuals involved? So the courts in the United States have very clearly said that physicians can't be involved in capital punishment. But they are in a number of states involved, for example, in force-feeding competent prisoners in order to make prisons run more effectively and more smoothly, even though it's not necessarily in the prisoner's interest. And courts have upheld that. So there's a wide range of how involved doctors can be. The other half of that is, to what degree should we accommodate patients engaged in abusive or criminal behavior in an international setting, war criminals, people engaged in torture. Obviously, nobody's saying that we should deny them medical care collectively, but do we have to afford them visas to the United States? Does an individual doctor have to treat them? Can I say it is my policy not to treat war criminals in non-emergent situations, and they should get care in their own country, and if they can't get care there, that's not my problem.
So does a doctor have that power? I'm not going to treat this person?
So generally, in a non-emergent setting, yes, in an emergent setting, no. But hospitals may have broader powers to say, we're not going to accommodate a foreign national coming to the United States, for example, for chemotherapy for a rare cancer, specifically if they have a good moral argument for doing so. So, for example, the leader of a hypothetical nation that doesn't allow its ordinary citizens to travel abroad for medical care, one might have a very good moral case for also not letting their leader to come to your country for medical care.
I'm glad you bring up in the book, Jacob, the subject of patients and providers sleeping together. This is certainly a staple of TV medical dramas, but in real life, what are some of the constraints there?
Sure. So it's very clear now in my field of psychiatry that physicians cannot have romantic or sexual relationships with either their patients or their former patients, which is actually a relatively new guideline dating from the 1970s, and there's some data that in the 1970s this was a fairly widespread phenomenon. And still occurs far more often than one might hope. With other physicians in different fields, certainly having a romantic relationship with a current patient is looked down upon and is usually not permitted. With a former patient, there's sometimes a washout period. But other questions arise. What about the relatives of the patient? Is it okay to have a romantic relationship with the mother of a pediatric patient, for example, or the relatives of former patients in psychiatry? And you might not want a one-size-fits-all, because using your hospital as a pickup lounge in New York City is deeply problematic. But if you're the only doctor in rural Alaska in a particular town, not letting you date the relatives of your former patients might substantially narrow your dating pool.
Let's move away from relationships with providers into the issue of body parts, and I would think this is a real growth area for ethicists.
Sure, in terms of the sale of body parts. Well, I think it raises larger questions about what rights one has to one's body after one dies, and who gets to make those sorts of determinations. At the most basic level, the topic of the book, the title of the book, is Who Says You're Dead, which is not an easy question to answer. People say, well, it's obvious you're either alive or you're dead, but it's not so obvious. In the old days, when you breathe in a mirror, it wasn't so obvious. Now, 48 states accept brain death as death, if you have no brain function at all. But many people only accept cardiopulmonary death, particularly certain religious people, people from certain cultural groups. So what happens if the state says your relative is dead, but you don't accept that definition? Can you bring your relative home on a ventilator, leave them in your living room? I tell people if I want to have my deceased grandmother embalmed and put on display in my living room like Lenin, we don't allow that to happen. Death has far more significance than simply a biological phenomenon, it's worth remembering. If you're dead, your spouse can remarry, your children can inherit, the government stops sending you Social Security checks, all sorts of implications. So deciding what happens to your body, to parts of your body after your day, is not an easy question.
Move on then to the issue of body identity integrity disorder. I've heard of this, and it's where people essentially don't believe that they don't believe they have the right hand or something, or they want to get the body part taken off, even though it's perfectly healthy.
Right, and the argument at least is this is not like body dysmorphic disorder. These are not people who simply are psychiatrically impaired and dissatisfied with the way they look. That people who suffer from this condition describe themselves more as patients who are transgender, who were born into one body but feel that they should have been born into a different body. And they will say, since early childhood, a particular limb or a particular part of my body never felt neurologically connected to the rest of me, and I want it removed. So there are obviously medical questions about that. Will the technology arise someday to fix that, for example? So should we have them hold off until that does? But also, what do you do with a patient who says, look, there are two possibilities. One, as a surgeon, you help me remove my alien hand medically in the hospital setting. Or if you won't do that, I'm going to go lie down on a railroad track and have it done in a way that might endanger other people because this is simply a desperate situation that I'm suffering from.
So what does the doctor do in that situation?
So I can tell you that one surgeon in Scotland tried doing this, a surgeon named Robert Smith, and that the National Health Service there shut him down and said he couldn't do it. It was unethical. It's not so clear what doctors do here, what they should do here. And there are a number of other areas where this question of when the patient says they're going to do something or the family is going to do something that puts them in worse danger, to what degree you can deviate from the ideal. So an area where this comes up are cases of so-called female surgical circumcision or female genital cutting. What you do with the parents of a daughter who says, look, we're going to do this procedure one way or the other. And the two options are we could do it sterilely in a clinic in a way that is not very invasive from their perspective, but may have significant sexual, biological pain implications for the patient, or we could do it in an unsanitary way in our home country and expose our daughter, who we love, to a higher risk of infection and illness and disease, and we really don't want to do that. Generally, the United States does not allow that to occur, though there are ongoing controversial court rulings on the subject, but it's a really controversial ethical question.
Well, and then some defenders of the practice lump it in with circumcision for males. I mean, as an ethicist, do you think that's a fair comparison?
Well, I think all of these things operate on a continuum, and all of them violate to some degree bodily integrity or autonomy in favor of some sense of collective good or interest. And there are widespread and divergent cultural practices. The one thing I urge people even more broadly to think about is to understand that people who, for example, vaccinate their children and people who don't vaccinate their children, or people who are abhor female genital cutting, or people who embrace it, all of them love their children. And until you understand that the people who disagree with you aren't evil people, they simply start with different premises that lead them to different conclusions, you're never going to be able to persuade them to share your viewpoint.
Let's move, Jacob, into the issue of xenotransplantation, parts from animals. We've done a fair amount of this already. I mean, it seems like there's not a whole lot left to go here.
So I think there have been a lot of efforts in the past, many of which have been unsuccessful. But there are questions about how much risk human beings should be able to accept. And then there are questions about to what degree animals are servants of man and to what degree we should be able to take advantage of animals or take animals' lives in order to help our own. So those are both sets of issues. A third area that will arise is to what degree we can actually create human beings for transplant. And there's always the possibility we will be able to create shell bodies, so anencephalic human beings that don't have any higher brain function or the capacity to have higher brain function, and use their organs to do transplantation into healthy functioning human beings. Again, another area which is somewhat hypothetical, but is very possible in the future.
It's interesting. The Superman comics dealt with this at least 20 years ago. The idea of tanks that contain your clones at different ages that you could then take their body parts and replace your own as they wear out. I guess we don't tend to deal with these issues until we have the technology. Is that the way it usually works?
Yeah, no, science fiction becomes science fact. My father's a physician. I remember going to the Star Wars movie with him as a kid and seeing one of the characters have a hand attached, and my father saying that science would never be able to do that, and now we do hand transplants.
Oh, right. Well, as long as we're on the issue of the transplants, let's talk about a brain or head transplant, because that comes up in the book. Has that actually been tried?
No. So there's at least one physician in Europe who has talked about doing this, and one patient who initially appeared interested, but my understanding is has backed out. But the question arises that with a patient who has, for example, a severe terminal illness like pancreatic cancer, wants to take the risk of having their brain transplanted, should we allow them to take that risk? Because it could, as someone might describe it, be a fate worse than death. It could be a brain trapped in a body with no ability to communicate in any way with the outside world, no sensory input or output that lived indefinitely. And we'd have no way of knowing whether you wanted to continue living that way or not. We could have more success in that and get you some functionality back, or at least some ability to communicate. It's not clear also who should get to make that decision, whether it should be a patient decision or a collective decision of the community. And it's also not clear that somebody who makes that choice really appreciates the risk in a meaningful way, especially because they're already under a great deal of pressure because they're dying.
So in less urgent circumstances, the idea of body modification, I mean, the things we might want to remove or add, I mean, does law dictate whether I can have a horn or cat ears, or is this simply up to a doctor who's willing to do it?
Well, as of now, it's generally up to a doctor with a few narrowly carved out areas, so to speak. But it's not that clear in the sense that by regulating who can do the procedures, we may make them harder and harder to obtain. So, for example, one issue that's come up repeatedly in various states is the issue of tongue forking, of making your tongue look like a lizard. And historically, this was something, when it was done, that was done in tattoo parlors. But now some states have said that's not safe, and they only let oral surgeons do it. But very few oral surgeons are willing to do it, and it's an extraordinarily expensive procedure when they do, which basically drives you out of the market of many people who want the procedure done.
I can't imagine having a now nothing against tattoo parlors, but that's a fairly significant bit of cutting right there. So were there any issues with people who got their tongues forked in tattoo parlors?
Not that I know of. I think the people who do this, and they're few and far between in tattoo parlors, are very good at it. It's not the thing where you just sort of go up to your bathroom, take a scissors and some string, and cut someone's tongue in half. I think these people usually get some meaningful training. To my knowledge, I don't think it's been formally studied, but you see the outcomes. They don't seem that different from the outcomes you get with oral surgeons.
I want to come back to the section of the book on making babies, which we touched on briefly earlier. I mean, it would seem like this is an area that may be head and shoulders above the rest in controversy, is it?
It can be. And obviously there are very controversial subjects like abortion and contraception for some people. But I try to take the book out of those areas to areas that are more nuanced. To get people who even think they know what their values are to sort of question what they really are. So, for example, there is the case of a British couple who are deaf, who had one daughter who was deaf and have a 50% chance of having another child who is deaf. And they went to the British Fertility Board, the organization that makes these decisions in Great Britain, and asked if they could use in vitro fertilization to guarantee that their second child would be deaf, because they believe in the value of deaf culture and they believe it is an other ability rather than a disability. And the British Fertility Board said no. To what degree do we let people design their own children? To what degree do we allow them to make choices that we would not make for them? That story had a happy ending in a way that the couple biologically had a deaf child, the natural way, so to speak, who ended up being deaf, and they were very pleased with that, and they have an integrated four-person family now. But what if the patient were blind or were in a chondroplasia dwarf? And then you can imagine the extreme. What about the mother who says, I want to have a disabled child? Do we allow someone to make that choice when their intent is to create a child who's disabled? And sometimes that might be a child in the exact same condition as another parent who says it's not a disability at all.
So we already have fertility clinics where there are embryos. I mean, can we tell from the DNA alone what child would result from that embryo if it were allowed to grow?
We can to some degree, and we're going to have that ability in an increasing way. And one question that arises, you often hear people say that this will lead to more inequality in society. That is not necessarily the case. You could make the argument that if these sorts of interventions were publicly funded, they would actually lead to greater equality in society, because there are two ways to do really well on your SAT scores. One way is to do what lots of upper middle class people do, which is hire an SAT tutor. And the other way is simply to have smarter children, which the government could fund for everybody biologically.
Wow. That would be some, that could be quite
a
discussion.
I'm not endorsing that, by the way. I'm just saying it's a possibility.
Right. I get that. So the idea of savior siblings, born to provide tissue to an ailing sibling. I mean, the tech does seem to help this, doesn't it?
Yeah, so and that is already the reality. But to what degree do we allow people to do that? And to what degree do we allow them to genetically engineer their second child to match their first child? And more broadly, what are your obligations to help a relative as a child, as an adult? Generally, the courts have said that adults have no obligation to help their relatives. There's a famous case of a man who had a rare type of bone marrow, I believe, whose cousin was the only person who could donate to keep him alive, and the cousin refused to do so. Not out of malice, he just didn't want to do it. And the court said there was no ethical obligation, no legal obligation. And I believe the patient who needed the donation died. There's no easy answer to any of it.
You mentioned earlier about a room full of people asked if they wanted to be cloned and no hands went up. I mean, what would be aside from the spare parts argument we talked about already, if you could clone people, why? You don't get the same person, right?
Well, it's interesting. There are certain small religious groups or sects, I believe the Raelians are one, who have cultural reasons they might want this done. But beyond that, most people, once they learn a lot about it, don't want to clone. And closely related to that, is that we fear genetic engineering. People will want to have, I don't know, taller, faster, blonde, blue-eyed children. It turns out that's not the case. When you actually ask people what kind of children they want children just like them. And the great thing about biology is if you have children the old-fashioned way, you get children that are an awful lot like you.
So broadly, there are issues here that involve less about the medical procedures and practices themselves and deal with the rights of an individual versus the rights of a group. There are several cases in different parts of the book, like a woman so nasty and disruptive, the clinic wants to ban her from her life-saving treatment or sort of quarantining people who could cause an epidemic. Is there a consistent doctrine here legally?
No, there's a lot of variation. I think the most iconic case that is well known to people is typhoid Mary. Mary was a woman who may or may not have carried yellow fever, typhoid, during the epidemic in New York City. And she, everywhere Mary went, typhoid followed her. And eventually the city decided that she was a public health threat, and they quarantined her on an island in the East River for many, many years. This occurs today, again, with patients who have resistant tuberculosis can be isolated, more recently with SARS, with Ebola. To what degree does a perfectly innocent person have to give up all of their liberty in order to protect the public? And there's no easy answer to that.
Wow. So over the course of your career, can you still be surprised? Is there an ethical dilemma that won't let you go?
Oh, I'm surprised all the time. But what I tell people is what surprises me more than the obscure, unusual dilemmas are the ordinary cases which could have been prevented if people had simply talked to their relatives or their loved ones about what they wanted done in complex situations or shared their values. But I tell people, I'm a professional bioethicist. I work in a hospital. It's bioethicists, and I admit I'm a bit biased, but I think we're great people. We're fun at parties. We're fun at weddings. We tell great stories. The one place you don't want to meet us is in the hospital. And the best way to avoid that is to sit down with your loved ones and share with them what your wishes are in terms of reproductive choice, in terms of end-of-life care, so that if you're ever incapacitated, they know what's to be done.
So think about the things you want from life, or more appropriately, from the end of life before you get there, which we've heard from many people on the exchange. But it's good to hear we should be inviting bioethicists to cocktail parties. Jacob Apple is a bioethicist, MD, psychiatrist, and Harvard Law graduate. He's the author of Who Says You're Dead? Medical and Ethical Dilemmas for the Curious and Concerned. Jacob, thank you for joining us today on the exchange.
My pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Take care.